This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Tiadam Sulongkumar, the host of this channel. And today I'm here with Dr. Susmita Nath to talk about her book, The Secular Imaginary, Gandhi, Nehru, and the Ideas of Nation. Now, I think as someone who dabbles into religion and who dabbles into idea of secularism and who is very interested in all of this aspect of life and reality, I think, and also as me, as someone who coming from India, I think I was very interested in the title of the book itself. And I think, and as I've traversed the writings and the ideas in the book, I was very fascinated by the work of the author. And interestingly, today I'm here sitting with the author herself, and then we'll be talking about this book as well. So I believe that the listeners will be enriched by the discussions that are here in the book and will be clarified about many more concepts that are emerging from India and also from the historical context of the writings of Gandhi and Nehru, and also see some implications for the Indian context today. Yeah, so let me straight away go to the author herself and let me start a conversation. So Dr. Susmita Nath, can you tell us something about yourself?
Sure, thanks. Thanks, Chitmisu, first of all, for inviting me to the podcast. I am a bit nervous because I've never done this before. So, So about myself, I'm a political theorist, and I'm interested in themes related to secularism and secularity, nationalism, populism, and democracy. My work generally focuses on intellectual and political histories of India, and I have a particular I try to look at these issues through the lens of what today we call global intellectual history, and as well as comparative social and political theory. So this comparative social and political theory, as it is conceived these days, is relatively new field. It's different from comparative politics. So comparative social and political theory makes this bold claim that theory does not just comes from the West. Theory also comes from the global South. So this is the prerogative with which comparative theory, social and political theory works. So my work largely looks at issues that I mentioned, secularism, populism, etc., through the lens of comparative political theory and intellectual history, global intellectual history.
Well, that's really interesting. And can you tell us something about what you are currently doing as of in terms of your affiliation with institutions?
Right. When I was writing this book, which was based on my doctoral and postdoctoral work, I was a postdoctoral fellow at this institute called the Multiple Secularities. This is based in Leipzig University, and this is a conglomerate of international scholars all working on the conception of secularity, religion and secularity, and looking at secularity both like in pre-modern and modern times, and you have like a group of historians, sociologists, political scientists. So this is where for the longest part I was based in, and I wrote my book there both during my doctoral and postdoctoral research. And after the book, I joined research group called Contestations of the Liberal Script. This is a research group based in Berlin at the Freie Universität. And there I was looking at the conception of populism as it is understood in India and practiced in India, as well in relation to the global rise and upsurge of populism in the world. So this is what I have been doing.
Yeah, quite interesting. Now, I think in any scholarly journey and any, you know, digging up any concepts and all, there's obviously a kind of story behind working on any topic or any subject. So what was the motivation behind working on this book and specifically working on this area for your PhD? Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's a mix of serendipity and my research interest, actually. In terms of my research interest, in my MPhil, I was looking at this assumed incommensurability between issues of gender equality and religion, freedom of religion. So, you know, political theory always starts with this assumed incompatibility between religious freedom on the one hand and questions of gender equality. And I was looking at the Muslim personal law with regard to that. And when I was looking at that question, secularism inadvertently became something that I had to engage with. So the topic of secularism came in. And so this is how I got into secularism in India, the debates on secularism in India. Then eventually, during my doctoral research, I was kind of dabbling with these debates on secularism. And what struck me when I was looking at these debates on secularism, it seemed to me, at least, that there was this huge debate about secularism in India in the 90s, you know, with the publication of Rajiv Bhargav's edited book, Secularism and Its Critics. And it seemed to me that that debate happened in the 90s and kind of was done with in the 90s itself. So it resolved. So there was a contradiction whether secularism is a Western concept or not, and how much of it is an Indian concept. And this, there was a vibrant debate, and to me it seemed that the debate was kind of ended there. And I still was kind of interested in these debates, and I thought that this debate kind of needs to be reopened from today's political hindsight, you know. I think a lot has changed since the 90s. So this was one motivation. And the other was when I was a PhD student in Jawaharlal Nehru University, the scholar Monica Woldrup-Saar, she is one of the directors of Multiple Secularities in Leipzig University. She was in JNU as well as a visiting fellow. And she presented a paper on multiple secularities. And that kind of caught my attention because I had not heard that term before she had presented the paper. And I was already reading a literature on multiple modernities, which has been engaged with by scholars like Charles Taylor, and in India by scholars like Sudipta Kaviraj. So I was really interested in what is this conception of multiple secularities that this scholar is talking about. And then I kind of started engaging with her works, and this is how I got into the topic of secularism and secularity, and this is how the book came about.
Yeah, quite an interesting journey indeed. Yeah. So as we move into the contents of the book, let's take a step ahead and clarify, I think, four concepts that has to do with secular. And the first one is actually the word secular in that sense. I mean, today when anyone says that I'm a secular person and all, it talks about a mode of being, right? Mode of being in the social reality itself. So what really is this secularism? Where did it come from and how did it play about in the Indian context?
Right. So one of the things that I try doing in the book right away, there's a chapter on just clarifying the terms secular, secularism, secularity, and secularization. And in the book, I have differentiated all these words, and the attempt has been to understand concepts of secularism, secularity, and secularization through this fixed understanding of the secular. So the secular, as we all know, has its origin in the Western world, or what Charles Taylor calls the Latin Christendom, right? And so it has a peculiar and a particular history in terms of that the word emerged in the Western history, right? According to Charles Taylor. So it has what Charles Taylor calls a certain embeddedness to it. There's a certain cultural, historical embeddedness where secular word emerged within the Latin Christendom. And he tells us that when the word first came about, it was a non-oppositional word to religion. It emerged within Christianity, and secular was simply the profane time as opposed to the higher time or the spiritual time, right? So it was simply a non-oppositional diet, as Taylor puts it. And then he says, over time, it becomes an oppositional diet, which means that secular came to be seen as in opposition to religion. Now, Charles Taylor's claim is that this is how secular came to be imagined, articulated in the West. This need not be so when this idea spread. So despite its embeddedness, you know, which we can trace back to Latin Christendom, despite its embeddedness, it need not, so this is the first thing he says, it need not be understood in the same oppositional manner, like where religion is opposed to secular, in other parts of the world. This was his first claim. And another claim that he made was even within Christianity, secular and religion was understood in various ways. And it was a highly contested and debated topic. So there was just not one single story that we are used to, which is that if you are secular, you are anti-religion. So this is what I begin with in terms of defining secular. And then I go on to define secularism, which is an ideology of the state, which means that the state needs to be impartial towards religious communities. Then I define secularity, which is a project which was taken up by Multiple Secularities Project, which looks at how do we demarcate, understand religion and so what is religion? What is secular? So this boundary making mechanism. So that is secularity. And secularization, as we know, is a social process which began with modernization. So yeah, very briefly, this is how I understand the secular and its cognates.
Yeah, thank you very much for precisely putting these four concepts in a very, you know, crisp manner to understand the process of the aspect of secular, the process of secularization, secularity, and secularism. So I think making that concept clear, let us move ahead to Gandhi and Nehru here. I think this book deals a lot on these two personalities from India. So firstly, let's go to Gandhi. So what was Gandhi's conception of political in that sense? How did Gandhi understood political? Yeah.
Right. Thanks for that question. This was actually one of the most challenging aspects when I began working on the question of the relationship between religion, state, and politics in Gandhi's thought, that how do I understand the political in Gandhi? Because Gandhi had a very unique understanding of political, in my view, which was not a certain dominant liberal understanding of political, which we inherited and learned from the British. So if you look at the book, the chapter on Gandhi actually begins with the question, what is the political? What is the political in Gandhi? And I say that unlike in most democratic theories, which is mostly a Western conception of democratic theories, you know, we assume that the political is always already there. You know, the political is there. You have the political subject, and the aim of democratic theory is to bring these people together for a common political project, right? But Gandhi began with this assumption, what if there is no political, right? To begin with. So his first step was the creation of a political subject. So what Lee Jenko talking about, she talks about Chinese politics, she talks about making the political. So Gandhi's attempt was to make the political through his conception of satyagraha and ahimsa. You know, ahimsa, which is nonviolence, and satyagraha is the political form of ahimsa. So in making the political, Gandhi kind of moved away from the dominant forms of the political, which was already there in the Indian subcontinent at the time, which was on the one hand, the liberal constitutional politics of the Indian National Congress. And on the other hand, we saw the revolutionary politics, the violent and the revolutionary form of politics that was practiced by our revolutionary leaders. So Gandhi kind of said that, you know, there is excessive use of force in revolutionary politics, which is, you know, the idea of is violence is central to it, to do away with injustice, right? On the other hand, liberal constitutionalism has very little or no conception of force because it's all based on petition. And Gandhi wanted imagined a new form of political where, you know, it's not lack of force, but also not excessive use of force. And this is how the political in Gandhi may be conceived, which is not a liberal, I imagine it is not a liberal understanding of the political.
So, I mean, moving on to the next one, since we are talking about secularism, so we need to understand what was Gandhi's conception of religion in that sense. So how did Gandhi understand religion? I mean, you look at the aspect of religion as faith and religion as discovery. So can you elaborate that a little bit more? Yeah.
Right. Oh, I'm so happy that you read the book so carefully. When I was reading on Gandhi's conception of religion, there is a lot of work on Gandhi's religion, and I was kind of drowning in that work without really getting a clear vision of what Gandhi's religion is. There's really, when it comes to Gandhi's political thought and Gandhi's conception of religion, there's just too much. What I did then was I started looking at other thinkers who talk about religion. And then I came across Muhammad Iqbal's essay on a religious reconstruction. I think it was called Islam and the Religious Reconstruction of Life or something like that. And there Muhammad Iqbal talks about religion in terms of thought, religion as... He talks about religion in terms of a process that it goes from religion as faith, and then there is thought, and then there is discovery. And this, I found this idea of religion as faith, thought, and discovery very interesting. And then I went back to Gandhi's thought and Gandhi's understanding of religion, and I realized that Gandhi is doing something similar in terms of what Iqbal was doing. So instead of this tripartite division, Gandhi is talking about religion in two languages. He does not differentiate like Iqbal. He is not differentiating, but Gandhi is talking about religion in two ways, as faith. And faith is something that is unquestionable. It is beyond reason. You unquestioningly accept it. So he talks about religion as faith. And then he talks about religion as discovery, which he links to an ethical life. So in religion as discovery, you have to practice an ethical life. And this is where Gandhi, in his ashram, started to live the religion that he propagated. So these are the two aspects of religion as ethical living, which requires experimentation with religion, which requires experience of ethical living. And there is the other part of religion, which is almost like an unthought religion as faith, which is beyond critical reflection. There is no critical, you just accept it as it is. And I think in Gandhi's thought, both these things are present. And this is the tricky bit in Gandhi's religion. So there is this aspect where it is absolutely, it's faith with which you cannot have, like, there is no rational understanding behind it. You just accept it. And there is this other aspect where you have constantly negotiate, understand religion by experiencing it, by practicing it, much like what he saw science was doing. So in terms of religion as ethical living, he equates it with the practice of science. And yeah, so this is how Gandhi thought and talked about religion, in my view, at least.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way of putting precisely the Gandhi's thought on religion. So as you have elaborated about Gandhi's conception of political and Gandhi's conception of religion, so how does these two come together? So can you please elaborate a little bit more about Gandhi's conception or the understanding of religion in politics in that sense? Yeah.
Right. So, you know, when Gandhi is talking about religion as ethical living, what does that mean? Religion as ethical living means that he has a certain holistic conception of religion, which means that his conception of ethical life extends to other aspects in social life, to the political, to the economic, to education. So unlike modern secularization theories, which say that in modern societies, we have clear differentiation and distinction of functions between religion, education, politics, science, Gandhi is saying no to that. And in Gandhi's ashram, everything is looked through the lens of religion. Right. And this is where his religion and politics comes together, where you cannot divorce religion from politics because any other aspect, like the economy, like science, like medicine, for Gandhi, even politics or the political should also be understood through the aspect of religion as ethical life. So this is where Gandhi's religion and politics came together. And I try to understand that by looking at Gandhi's ashram, because much of what he did at a larger scale on the Indian subcontinent was first tried and tested within the ashram. So the ashram was like a test site, you know. He experimented there. If it worked, then he kind of put it to practice on the larger Indian subcontinent. So this is how his religion and politics came together.
Yeah. So zooming out to the greater national level, you talk about Gandhi's way of common action and political unity, and you give three aspects of it. That is, you talk about the associational politics, associational activities, and associational living. And I think this is quite interesting in that sense when Gandhi look at the broader perspective from a national perspective. So can you elaborate a little bit more on these aspects?
Right. So this idea of Gandhi's associationalism came from this realization that Gandhi's politics does not adhere to any of the demands or expectations of liberal politics. So then I had to look beyond the categories of liberal political thought and liberal politics. And then I kind of came up with this idea of associationalism. And I owe much to Rudolf and Rudolf, who also talk about Gandhi's associational politics. But I kind of expand on that. And I say it's not just associational politics, which means that in politics, you have to be political friendship becomes more important first That is the first step towards, and then you can have political pacts and negotiations, which is the liberal kind of understanding of political. So for Gandhi, political friendship was the first step. So this is what is essentially associational politics that I talk about. And then associational activity was for Gandhi was the first step towards having a better society, or which is that through social work, and as we know, Gandhi's constructive program was central to this. So it is a bottom-up approach where you don't try to radically change the socio-political, but you have incremental changes through reform. So reform is central to envisioning a certain form of social change. And this is where associational activity becomes important, which is essentially forms of social activity, social work, which begins from bottom up. So you can contrast this associational activity and associational politics that I elaborate in my book to the kind of politics that, for instance, someone like Nehru does, where the social does not have the primacy as much as the political has the primacy. So our political leaders like Ambedkar and Nehru sought to do away with the injustices in society, like the caste system, through a radical transformation. They wanted to radically transform society with the help of the state. So the state became central to change. Gandhi kind of can be seen as someone who is right in the opposite spectrum to this, where he thought you cannot have a radical transformation of society. He actually went for something like forms of reform. So you can slowly transform society through smaller steps of reform. Of course, there is a problem with such an understanding of reform that, you know, when you have such systemic injustice like the caste system and untouchability, how can someone who is undergoing, felt the injustice of caste system, except the slow reform. So, of course, there is this question of how effective is Gandhi's social reform. These are the three aspects: associational activity, associational politics, and the last is associational living, which again is not unique to Gandhi, as I say, and there were other thinkers who thought about in the same line, which is that you don't have to look at the long history of Indian subcontinent to say that, look, we were all living together happily, even in the past. You know, there is this composite culture, syncretic culture, and which has resulted in tolerance. Gandhi did none of that sort. He was not interested in the Indian history as much, although he did talk about it here and there, that Hindus and Muslims are brothers. But what he was more interested in terms of associational living, was that when people come together and live together for a long period of time, you share not just sorrows, but also happiness. This common sharing of sorrows and happiness, this common sharing of a social world, creates a certain kind of solidarity. And this solidarity is what, on the basis of which a nation should be built on. And this is exceptional in terms of imagining a nation in these terms, because in the 19th century, nation was imagined in terms of common religion, language, ethnicity, and whatnot, right? And Gandhi is kind of saying no to all that and saying that what brings us together is our common happiness and sorrows. What brings us together is this experiencing and living together for this long a time. So it does not matter how the past was, it's how we are at present living together, you know, and how we are experiences of living together. So this becomes an important aspect of Gandhi's political thought in terms of associational living. And I try to bring all these different aspects of associational living, associational politics, and associational activity to talk about a larger understanding of associationalism in Gandhi's political thought.
Yes. Now you have touched a little bit on the aspect of how countries think about religious tolerance in that sense. And I think in the Indian context, the very aspect of religious tolerance is an important topic. So can you elaborate something more on Gandhi's idea of religious tolerance and also its relation to the state, how he understood this function of the state to be in terms of, you know, look, understanding religion and its the aspect of tolerance?
Right. So actually, when it comes to the conception of tolerance in Gandhi's thought, we see that the state is not very important or very relevant to the conception of tolerance that Gandhi has. And again, with tolerance, there is this assumption in Gandhi's thought that no religion is perfect. And because no religion is perfect, there is the possibility of reform within every religion. And it is through this lens that he approaches the question of tolerance in his political thought and in his politics. In mainstream nationalism, how tolerance is perceived is sarv dharm sambhav, and which is equality of all religions. And Gandhi also talks about equality of all religions, but there is a conceptual distance between how Gandhi perceived tolerance and how it came to be reflected in the Indian or the nationalist mainstream conception of tolerance in Indian secularism, for instance. So when Gandhi talks about equality of all religions through conceptions like sarv dharm sambhav, he is thinking about tolerance in terms of, not in terms of composite culture or not in terms of miscibility of cultures, which is how generally we talk about tolerance. You know, this Nehruvian heritage that there is this great history, past history in India of all religions mingling together. We borrow from each other. In India, we have an example of syncretic and composite cultures, and this is an example of tolerance. In Gandhian political thought, this is not so. He is actually talking about tolerance in terms of what I say in the book as unassimilable differences. So differences that cannot be mixed together, you know. So you have your differences in terms of being a Hindu, in terms of being Christian or Muslim. So these differences cannot be mixed or are not miscible. And yet you develop an idea of tolerance. So this idea of miscibility is completely missing from Gandhian understanding of tolerance. So how do you practice tolerance? For Gandhi, this was the challenge. How do you practice tolerance despite you being an orthodox Hindu, which he considered himself to be, despite one being an orthodox Muslim, and despite one being an orthodox Christian, and so on? So despite, or in spite of that, how do you practice tolerance? And for Gandhi, then associationalism comes in to understand and practice tolerance that ways.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for that. So now moving on to Nehru, another personality that you talk about in this book. And now there's a shift in discourse happening when Nehru is coming into the context, or when Nehru comes into the context of the Indian political discourse. So to go straight into the question, what was Nehru's idea of modernity?
Right. So in the book, there's a section where I titled it for Nehru's conception of modernity, I say modernity in Swaraj and Swaraj in modernity. What I mean by that, for Nehru, it was absolutely essential that we do away with colonial rule to really realize modernity. Because for Nehru, what impeded progress and development in India was the colonial rule. So for Nehru, modernity was inextricably linked to colonial rule, and therefore the first step towards realizing modernity for Nehru was doing away with colonial rule. And then the second step then was that you have the state-led form of development that we are all aware of industrialization, of science and development. Like a scientific science takes a predominance in a Nehruvian conception of modernity. And through state-led development, through science, Nehru understood the development and progress of society.
Yes. And when we look at Nehru, you have argued that Nehru distinguishes religion from modernity and spirituality. Now, so how does this Nehru's notion of religion in relation to political works out in his thought and work?
Right. So unlike Gandhi, Nehru actually thought that it is possible not only to separate religion from politics. Nehru actually thought that you could separate religion and politics. But not only that, but also it was desirable to do so. So when I say that, it does not mean immediately that then Nehru was anti-religious. No, not at all. Nehru was a kind of liberal political thinker and politician who, for whom politicized religion was not really an acceptable form of politics or acceptable form of politics within a liberal polity. So this is how Nehru came to conceive the relationship between religion and political. And in the book, I also say that, you know, there's this generally, like from this understanding of the political and religion, there is this immediate conclusion that Nehru was anti-religious. This is not so. If we look at Nehru's stance on the Uniform Civil Code, which I talk about in the book regarding Hindu court bills, for instance, if we look at Nehru's stance on these issues, we realize that Nehru did have a deep respect for religion, but he had a particular understanding of the relationship between religion and politics, and he did think that politicization of religion was not the best way forward for the Indian polity. And much of it was, of course, based on his past experience, where by the time Nehru came into politics, it was a very divisive kind of sort of politics in the 1930s, where, you know, communalism was at its all-time high, and we have politics, especially in terms of what we know as communal politics. So it is from this kind of understanding we have to realize that Nehru had his conception of how religion and politics should relate to each other.
Yeah. And in Nehru's thought, the idea of secularity and secularism becomes more articulated in that sense. So how did Nehru think about, or what was his conception of secularity and secularism in that sense? Yeah.
Right. Following the definitions of secularity and secularism in the book, I say that in Nehru's political thought, actually, we see two understandings of secularity. And I label the first understanding of secularity as a nationalist conception of secularity, and the second as humanist universal. And in the nationalist understanding of secularity, which is very present in his book, The Discovery of India, we see that this kind of secularity is attributed to India's past in the ancient and medieval period, where there is this kind of secular understanding of religion. Nehru says that this kind of approach to religion in a very secular manner is what is actually the essence of religion generally in India. And that is why, despite all the perversions that has happened to religion over several thousand years, we still see this secular aspect still present in the Indian subcontinent in the form of composite culture, in the form of syncretic cultures. So this is where we see this kind of nationalist understanding of secularity in Nehru's thought. And then the humanist universal was more following kind of the Western experience of secularity, where Nehru says that he kind of uses this Hegelian language of spirit of the age, and he says that the spirit of the age in the 20th century is a certain humanism. And he attributes this humanism to the advent of secularity. So this secular humanism is what he calls is the spirit of the age. So this is not particular to the West. It is how today's world society should be like a progressive understanding of society should be seen. And this is through this secular humanist understanding, he says, this is not an attribute of the West, but it's a universal aspect. And this humanism, this universal secular humanism, is what Nehru thought that should be applied or accepted in terms of an Indian secularity. So in Nehru we see these two conceptions of secularity side by side, this nationalist version and the secular humanist version, and they kind of come together to in his conception of secularity as an Indian secularity, if we can call it so that. Secularism, on the other hand, as I said, is a state ideology. And there, what Nehruvian secularism, how we can understand Nehruvian secularism is that democracy is equally important as secularism. So democratic values are equally important as secularism, and this is where kind of Indian secularism can be distinguished from, like, say, more heavy-handed secularism of, say, some countries in the world, where it is, although secularism is a top-down approach, Nehru always understood it alongside democratic ethos and values, and they kind of went side by side. And what I mean by that is that if secularism and democracy goes together, it means that for Nehru, at least, that at certain times you have to give in to the democratic demands. And it is this balancing between secularism and democratic ethos that I think forms the basis of Nehruvian secularism, which was not so important to for instance, later governments that came in, and for instance the current political predisposition, where secularism is really kind of disconnected from its democratic ethos. So secular values and democratic ethos go together in Nehruvian secularism.
Yes. That's a quite good articulations of Nehruvian secularity and secularism. Now, in your book, you talk about this distinguishing aspect of Nehruvian secularity versus the ideology of Nehruism, so which emerged in the 1970s and 80s, as you talk about. So what is this distinguishing aspect in terms of Nehruvian secularity and the ideology of Nehruism?
Right. So I attribute this Nehruism, follow this term from Kaviraj, how he uses it. Nehruism is a certain form of ideology which was really used by Nehru's daughter Indira Gandhi to propagate a certain form of populist politics. So a lot of things that Indira Gandhi did was only in name, and they not just Nehruvian secularism, but a lot of other Nehruvian ideas became more symbolic than actually having any substance, which was the case in Nehru's time. So secularity took this perverse form under Indira Gandhi, where it was kind of delinked from its humanist articulations. So as I said, that Nehru had this universal humanist understanding of secularity. So humanism was central to his conception of secularity. This completely goes missing in Indira Gandhi's time, and her authoritarian populism kind of uses Nehruvian ideas, including Nehruvian secularism and Nehruvian secularity, to propagate her politics. So it was really delinked from certain central Nehruvian values. So in that sense, Nehruism is very distinct from Nehruvian secularity, and this is the heritage that we have kind of inherited, where a religion came to be seen so opposed to the secular. This was not so necessarily so in Nehru's political thought, but increasingly so in Indira Gandhi's time, and this is what we have inherited from that era. So it is now whenever someone talks about secularism in India, we suddenly enter in this charged environment that where either you are secular or you are anti-religion. There is no other way. So we can, if we trace back, a lot of it can be traced back to Indira Gandhi's populist politics.
Yeah, I think that's a very good understanding of Nehru and how we have inherited a certain aspect of his thoughts through his daughter. And I think that's a very interesting way of looking at the aspect of Nehru's politics in that sense and his understanding of secularity. So moving on to, again, to looking at Nehru, and since Nehru was in the pedestal of making decision in the in India after the when India got independence, so when we look at Nehru, so let's put it this way, right? What was his engagement in Indian politics in terms of the partition of India, and also at the same time in terms of the post-colonial as such? What was Nehru's engagement and contribution to the political sphere in that sense?
Right. In one aspect where actually Nehru and Gandhi met, there were a lot of differences in terms of how they imagined the political, how they imagined the idea of India, as I put it in the book. There was much difference between Gandhi and Nehru, but one of the aspects where they met was the imagination of India, not in terms of common religion, ethnicity, language, and so on. So Nehru did not think that a nation is based on common religion, ethnicity, language. And this is what animated his politics as well. Take up any issue in Indian politics, be it the language question, or be it the question of the relationship between religion and politics, and of course how the nation is imagined. We see that Nehru is saying that religion is unimportant to an imagination and construction of the nation. So like Gandhi, when the partition happened, Nehru also is kind of says in his work that this is historically unprecedented. This could not have happened. So Gandhi talks about the partition in terms of a vivisection of the nations, and Nehru also talks about the partition in a similar manner, that this was not what historically was supposed to happen. Because the nation is not supposed to be on the basis of common religion. So this is how he understood partition. This was, and this is then understand. So, but having said that, partition did have a very deep impact on Nehru. Thinking, you have to realize that for a politician and a thinker who thought that, you know, a nation cannot be based on common religion, language, etc., suddenly it did happen that there was another nation that was based on a common religion of Islam. So this deeply, deeply affected Nehru. And so I say that there is a shift in Nehru's political thought, at least, which is that that Nehru conceives liberal politics and in terms of what is known as political thought, what is known as liberalism of fear. And what liberalism of fear says that you do not just assume that constitutional rights are equally given to everyone as a citizen. You do not assume that. You realize, you begin from the fact that it is a reality that political rights are not equally given to everyone, and not everyone experiences rights in the same manner. When you realize that, how do you shape a society? How do you shape the politics of a society when you have that realization? And in my book, I argue that Nehru began, so he changed his political stance, and then he looked at the question of reservation, for instance, the question of minority rights, for instance, through this lens of liberalism of fear. So yeah, this is what I argue in my book.
Yes, I think very pertinent articulations of Nehru's engagement in the political arena, and how, you know, he changed his thought in terms of articulating his whole process of trying to understand the political and the religion in the in India. Is, yeah. So now this will be my last question, and I think I mean, with all the discussions that we have had, I mean, there has been hints of this question that I'm going to ask, but I think to be very much precise and clear with, you know, what your thoughts are on this, let me, you know, put forth this question. And the question is this, that, you know, when we look at the Indian context today with the political and the social cultural environment, and also for the future days to come, what are the things that we should take from Gandhi and Nehru in terms of understanding the religion and politics, in terms of the everyday engagement that we will be having and will have in the days to come? Because today the environment has become a little bit different, and obviously we are hoping that the environment will change for the better in the days to come. So what will be the takeaway in that sense? Yeah.
Right, I think that's a great question to close this talk. And actually, I came to write this book in terms of this idea of the Gandhi-Nehru tradition, which we haven't talked about so far, and I will try to answer your question through this Gandhi-Nehru tradition. So what is this Gandhi-Nehru tradition? We hear it very often in political debates, and yet it's intriguing in the sense that Gandhi and Nehru had such opposing ideas of India. And when you enter a charged environment, normatively charged environment on debates on secularism, Gandhi and Nehru are posed in the opposite camps. And yet we talk about this Gandhi-Nehru tradition. So very quickly, this Gandhi-Nehru tradition is emerged during the 20th century. And although Gandhi and Nehru have their names on it, there were other political leaders who contributed to this imagination of India in terms of the Gandhi-Nehru tradition. And these other political leaders were thinkers like Rabindranath Tagore. You even had Rajendra Prasad, Subhash Chandra Bose, Maulana Azad. All these people were talking in one voice regarding the imagination of India. And it is this, which now today has become marginal. So what is this Gandhi-Nehru tradition which has become marginal? Is this idea of the secular, which connoted both societal tolerance and an impartial state. So this Gandhi-Nehru tradition talked about this idea of tolerance and state impartiality through ideas of unity in diversity and sarvdharm sambhav. So both these ideals of unity in diversity and sarvdharm sambhav were essential to the Gandhi-Nehru tradition. So when I say unity in diversity, it means it is a conception where a nation is not based on common religion, language, etc., right? What Rajendra Prasad says, that let India remain an unnational state that it is. This is the idea of unnational state emerged at a time when you had this dominant understanding of the post-Westphalian state, which was the dominant way of imagining the nation. But are these leaders that I just mentioned imagined Indian nation in terms of a multinational state, or Rajendra Prasad calls the unnational state? So this is one aspect of the Gandhi-Nehru tradition. And the other aspect of the Gandhi-Nehru tradition is state impartiality and tolerance that are brought together in terms of understanding secularism. Now, what has happened today in India today, that this understanding of this Gandhi-Nehru tradition has become marginal. It is only there symbolically. And if at all someone talks about it in a positive manner, if at all that is, then it is in a very distorted way. So I think it is time we bring back, revisit this Gandhi-Nehru tradition, how it has become marginalized, why it has become marginalized. Today in the morning, I was reading the newspaper and there was this big advertisement about some festival in northeastern India. And instead of, you know, looking at something like, there was this phrase called unity in identity. And I was really struck by it today morning. I was like, when did we move from unity in diversity to unity in identity? So I think this is this shift that has happened in Indian polity and Indian society, both at the level of polity and at the level of society, that we have to really seriously consider to take the challenge of majoritarianism, to take the challenge of extremist right-wing Hindu nationalism right on. So if we want to do that, I think we need to revisit the values of the Gandhi-Nehru tradition.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. And so is there anything that I've missed out that you want to articulate from your book?
No, not really. I just wanted to say like few quick words about the title of the book, why I called it The Secular Imaginary. So it is called The Secular Imaginary, and I borrowed the word imaginary from, you know, Charles Taylor's work, where he talks about the modern social imaginaries. And there he says that a social imaginary is different. An imaginary is different from a theory in the sense that imaginaries are how ordinary people imagine their world, right? As opposed to, say, intellectuals. Imaginaries, therefore, are represented not in theoretical terms, but they are carried out in images, in stories, and in legends. Imaginaries have a widely shared of legitimacy through such common practices. And I feel that this Gandhi-Nehru tradition lived in the 20th century and kind of continues to live, although kind of in a recessed manner, through an imaginary more than its political form. And that is why I kind of decided to title the book as The Secular Imaginary. That was the only thing I would have liked to add.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. That's a very, you know, good way of titling a book in terms of the intellectual history attached to it, in terms of how you have kind of conceptualized your thesis. That's a very good title in that sense. So thank you very much, Dr. Susmita Nath, for being here at New Books Network. Now, my last question again will be this one, that is there any other project that you are working on? And also, if anyone wants to reach out to you regarding your book, then, you know, an email, or which will be the better way to reach out to you?
Right. So my current project is on populism, because this is a theme that kind of emerged when I was looking at secularism and secularity, and I realized that Indira Gandhi's populism had much to do with how Indian politics today is structured and shaped. And of course, Narendra Modi, the current Prime Minister of India, is also, his politics is also associated with a certain form of populism. So, and given the this global explosion of populism worldwide, I thought, this was a topic that was just there to be engaged with. So this is my current project on populism. Regarding the book, yes, I'm more than happy for anyone to get in touch with me if they want to have a chat about the book or any future engagement. I'm more than happy to do that. I'm not very active on social media, but I can be reached via email and as well as via academia. I try to upload all my work there, and I'm quite regular on that platform. So via academia or Gmail.
Thank you very much, Dr. Susmita Nath, for being here at New Books Network. I hope that listeners will be enriched through this conversation. Also, envision better way of trying to understand religion and politics in India itself. And I hope that listeners will have a lot of takeaways from this conversation. So thank you, Dr. Susmita Nath, for being here at New Books Network, and take care.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.